John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for 25th September through October 1st, 2010. Peace talks at stalemate as settlement activities continue. Meanwhile, settler attacks and activities increase in the West Bank following the end of the settlement freeze. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report as usual with the nonviolent activities in the West Bank. This week, dozens were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation on Friday when Israeli troops attacked the weekly anti-wall protest in the central West Bank village of Belain. International Israeli supporters joined the villagers after the midday prayers at the local mosque and marched towards the wall built on local farmlands. People demanded the halt of construction in West Bank settlements and asked Palestinian leaders to unite. As soon people reached the gate of the wall separating villages from their lands, troops stationed there showered them with tear gas. Dozens of civilians were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. 2 years ago, the Israeli High Court of Justice ordered the Israeli military to remove the part of the wall built on Belain land, and the army still refuses to comply. Also on Friday, in the nearby Nilain village, Israeli troops used tear gas to suppress an anti-wall protest organized by the villagers and their Israeli and international supporters. People managed to get near the wall before troops fired tear gas at them. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. In the village of Nabi Saleh, also in central West Bank, villagers along with international Israeli supporters marched after the midday prayers towards local farmers' lands where Israeli government is planning to build a wall. As soon as the people reached their lands, soldiers stationed there used tear gas and sound bombs to stop the march. A number of people were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. In Bethlehem, the villagers of Al-Masara held on Friday their weekly protest against the Israeli wall being built on their lands. Villagers were joined by Israeli and international supporters shortly in the protest that started after the midday prayers. As protesters were marching towards the construction site of the wall, Israeli soldiers stopped stopped them at the entrance of the village and showered them with tear gas bombs in an attempt to force them back into the village. A number of residents and internationals were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. As Israeli-Palestinian peace talks have not moved forward, EU's Foreign Relations Chief Catherine Ashton in the region for possible mediation, while Washington's envoy George Mitchell is holding talks with both sides this week. IMEMC's Roman Mirari has the details.
An Israeli newspaper, Israel Now, reported that Israel is considering a compromise in which Israel will resume small-scale settlements building in the occupied West Bank, as well as remove some of the movement restrictions over there within the upcoming year of peace talks between the Palestinians and Israelis. The proposal was drafted during a recent meeting between Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak and American officials in Washington. According to such a proposal, the newspaper adds, Israel would only build 1,200 settlement units inside major settlement blocks under direct supervision by the Israeli government and away from media outlets. Palestinian sources, including President Mahmoud Abbas, have rejected any resumption of settlement construction and reiterated position that there can't be peace talks with settlements building going on. To Palestinian negotiator Saeb Erekat was quoted as saying this week that Israel has the clues for peace in the region. Erekat was hinting at Israeli acceptance of a freeze of settlements building before engaging in intensive peace talks within 1 year from now. On September 26, a moratorium on settlements construction came to an end, and since then, media reports said that some construction has taken place against the wishes of Palestinians and the American administration, which has repeatedly demanded Israel to stop such buildings and give a chance for peace talks to succeed. Washington is determined to observe a concrete progress in terms of Palestinian-Israeli peace talks within 1 year, leading eventually to a two-state solution. In the meantime, Egyptian Foreign Minister Ahmed Abul Ghait downplayed remarks by Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman in New York, in which Lieberman proposed a land swap between Palestinians and Israel and maintained that peace cannot be achieved soon. A statement by the office of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denied that Lieberman's remarks represented Israel's official stance regarding peace with the Palestinians. In Gaza, Palestinian Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh of the Islamist Hamas Party called for rejecting all peace talks and supported continuation of the Palestinian struggle against the Israeli occupation. On the internal level, a meeting in Damascus between representatives of the Fatah Party of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and the Islamist Hamas dealt with outstanding issues that hamper reaching a unity deal between the two parties. Both sides agreed to meet once again next week in order to sort out the remaining issues. According to political analysts, a unity deal between Hamas and Fatah could make its chances of peace between Israel and the Palestinians more possible. Rami Al-Mighari, IMEMC.org, Gaza.
Israeli settlers stepped up their attacks and activities in the West Bank following statements by Israeli officials of not renewing the settlement freeze. Meanwhile, the Gaza closure resumes. The details with IMEMC's George Shmawi.
During this week, Israeli forces killed four Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and fifth dies of wounds. On September 24th, Israeli gunboats opened fire at fishermen near a Sudania beach in the northern Gaza city, killing Mohammed Bakr as he was fishing together with his relatives. A spokeswoman for the Israeli military stated that Bakr was in restricted waters, quote, heading towards Israel, end quote. Israeli gunboats frequently chase Palestinian fishermen in the sea and threaten their source of livelihood through continuously firing at their boats, detaining them, and confiscating their fishing tools. On September 25th, medical sources at Nasser Hospital in Egypt declared that Mohammed Al-Amarin, 21, from a Zaytun neighborhood in the southeast of Gaza City, died of wounds sustained by Israeli forces in the central Gaza Strip on September 14th. Also in the Gaza Strip, Israeli military stationed at the Strip borders with Israel opened fire at Palestinian protesters who demonstrated near Abasan village east of Khan Yunis against the establishment of a buffer zone and the fence that isolates the coastal region. Sulaiman Abu Anza, 20, was seriously wounded by a bullet to the abdomen. On September 28th, Israeli warplanes launched two airstrikes against Palestinian targets in the Gaza Strip, killing three Palestinians and damaging a civilian home that belongs to Kamal Abu Shammal, the dead were said to be members of the Palestinian armed resistance. Additionally, Israeli military opened fire at two workers in two separate incidents, wounding them as they were collecting ballast from evacuated settlements in the Gaza Strip as part of their daily work to secure food for their families. In the West Bank, Israeli forces invaded residential areas 24 times this week, during which 13 civilians were abducted, and Israeli troops stationed at checkpoints inside the West Bank abducted three other civilians. In addition, Israeli settlers attacked a number of olive orchards and stole the olives as the Palestinian farmers started the olive harvest season in some of the West Bank areas. In Jerusalem, 13-month-old baby Muhammad Abu Sara died as a result of inhaling tear gas fired by Israeli police in Al-Isawiya village. The baby was exposed to tear gas three times in less than 24 hours. In the first two times, medical treatment saved his life. However, the third time was fatal. On the other hand, Israeli settlers increased activities and assaults against Palestinian civilians following Israel's end-of-10-month settlement freeze, which was accompanied by statements made by Israel senior officials that there will be no extension for the freeze. On September 25th, the eve of the end of the freeze, Israeli settlers from Ravafa settlement seized dozens of dunams of land in Deir Istia village northwest of Salfit. According to eyewitnesses, the settlers placed 22 mobile homes on 10 acres of land. In addition, Israeli settlers from Givat Zaif settlement broke into a Zaytun area near Ramallah and organized celebrations for the Jewish Sukkot holiday. Later, Israeli forces moved into the area and evacuated the settlers. On the same day, Israeli settlers from Nikodim settlement placed three mobile homes near Jibbeth Zeeb village east of Bethlehem. The following day, dozens of armed Israeli settlers accompanied by bulldozers and escorted by Israeli forces continued to lay foundation for a new settlement known as Havat Maon near Maon settlement to the east of Yatta village south of Hebron. On the same day, Silvan Shalom, deputy Israeli prime minister and the former minister of foreign affairs, laid the cornerstone of a Jewish religious school near Be'er Romano settlement outpost in Hebron in a celebration that was attended by a number of leaders of settlers and rightist members of the Israeli Knesset, who encouraged more settlement activities and seizure of Palestinian property. Despite the fact that Palestinian negotiators threatened to quit peace talks if settlement activities continue, the Israeli government is not acting in any way to stop the settlement activities, which puts the entire peace process in jeopardy. For IMEMC.org, this is George Rishmal.
And that was just some of the news from this week in Palestine. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Qassis and Dina Awad.
Afghanistan today. Two NATO Georgian soldiers were killed by a roadside bomb in Helmand Province. Afghanistan yesterday. Five NATO soldiers were killed in southern Afghanistan, three by the same bomb. Baghdad, Iraq, Tuesday. An American soldier shot and killed two fellow U.S. soldiers and wounded another following an argument, the military reported Tuesday. Fort Hood, Texas. Four GIs have committed suicide in the past week, one killing his wife at the same time. Baghdad, Iraq. Wednesday, two rockets hit the heavily fortified Green Zone, which has come under an intensifying barrage of rocket attacks in recent weeks. Shiite resistance fighters like the Promised Day Brigade, allied with Muqtada al-Sadr, have been credited with the rocket attacks. So far this year, there have been 134 rocket or mortar attacks in Baghdad, according to the American military commander in Baghdad, Brigadier General Ralph O. Baker. Of those, 49 have come in the last 90 days. Pakistan yesterday. Pakistani government has cut off the main supply line to U.S. occupation troops in Afghanistan in response to an American airstrike that morning that killed 3 Pakistani soldiers. This began with U.S. helicopters crossing the border during a battle and receiving warning fire not to violate Pakistani airspace. They returned fire and killed 3 Pakistani soldiers. Outraged, the Pakistani government has shut down NATO's main supply line into Afghanistan. Pakistan today. Presumed insurgents burned over 24 NATO fuel tankers carrying fuel to U.S. and NATO occupation groups in Afghanistan, taking advantage of the backups caused by yesterday's closure of the main supply route used by NATO. Pakistan today. Another NATO helicopter crashed, 3 wounded. No report on whether it was shot down. Afghanistan. Ongoing investigation. The kill team case of U.S. soldiers who killed Afghan civilians for fun just keeps getting worse. Staff Sergeant Calvin R. Gibbs has 6 skulls tattooed on his leg for civilians he murdered and allegedly has collected the fingers of his victims as trophies, according to the Washington Post. The U.S. military is desperately trying to round up all his digital photos before they come out for another Abu Ghraib-type scandal. Another soldier in his unit said nearly the whole unit smokes hashish. Washington, D.C., Wednesday. Admiral Mike Mullen, the Pentagon's top officer, said Wednesday that the kill squad allegations that drug use could have been a factor in one unit's decision to allegedly kill Afghans for fun raises questions about troops' use of hashish in Afghanistan. Hashish is plentiful and easy to obtain in Afghanistan, and its use has long been a source of concern for U.S. officials trying to gauge the performance of Afghan soldiers and police. Those officials are now increasingly discussing whether hashish use is also spreading among American soldiers in Afghanistan, or rather the current case is an aberration. Doesn't this sound like the widespread use of drugs by U.S. soldiers in Vietnam? Mr. Barack Obama, doesn't this sound like the U.S. has had enough of war? Doesn't this sound like the last years of the Vietnam War? We all know how that one ended, with helicopters desperately pulling America's friends off a downtown rooftop in Saigon. Unless you want that kind of thing to happen again on your watch, now's the time to get your people out. Withdraw all the troops, all the mercenaries, and all their collaborators from both wars today. Till then, sounds like all that hash means someone in Afghanistan has found another way to stone the Americans. Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. On the last day of September, corrupt police staged a coup attempt in Ecuador, assaulting President Rafael Correa physically at their protest against pay cuts driven by a budget crisis. They beat him and fired tear gas at him and his bodyguards, but they escaped into a hospital in Quito, Ecuador's capital. The coup attempt began when cops staged a protest against pay cuts driven by a budget crisis. When the president showed up, he was attacked and driven into that hospital, leading to a day-long siege. Finally, the Ecuadorian military, still loyal to a popular, left-leaning president who shut down U.S. military bases in Ecuador, stormed the hospital where President Rafael Correa was effectively being held hostage. The rescue was successful, though reportedly five Ecuadorian soldiers were wounded as the mutinous police met the assault with sheets of gunfire.
Some of those that work forces are the same that bar crosses.
Shortly before 11 p.m. D.C. time, President Correa returned to the presidential palace in Quito before huge cheering crowds opposing the coup attempt, where he gave this address, recorded here in part from Al Jazeera's coverage and translation.
I cannot thank you enough for all of your support. Let this be a warning to those who try to bring about change, not through the polls, but through conspiracy to work against the will of the citizens. We see what this has caused. I also wish to express thanks to the thousands and thousands of colleagues and friends, brothers and sisters who went to try to rescue me. When the police acted cowardly and received them with pepper spray and tear gas, how they can call themselves police? How can they call themselves police when they act this way against the people? Many thanks to the people who came from the different provinces around the country who mobilized to support the national government and the citizens' revolution and democracy in our country.
That's the sound of the people of Ecuador turning back a right-wing coup attempt by mutineering cops. Now let's see if the responsibility for that failed coup attempt leads back to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, where old Central America hands and the U.S. State Department like the assholes that told the Honduran coup leaders they could wait out President Obama's term in office.
For the past 64 years, the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia has been graduating assassins, dictators, and death squad leaders to do the dirty work of the elite in Latin America. The taxpayer-funded SOA has left a trail of violence and suffering in every country where its graduates have returned. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been tortured, raped, assassinated, disappeared, displaced, and massacred by those trained at the SOA. Enough is enough. Every year, thousands gather in Georgia to protest U.S. military involvement in Latin America. Join us at the gates of the SOA this November to honor the victims, celebrate the resistance, and pressure our government to shut down the school once and for all. From November 18th to 21st, we will have live concerts, speakers from around the world, street theater, workshops, and more. For more information on how you can stand with us to end the injustice, visit SOAW.org or call 202-234-3440.
Since 2006, more than a dozen of Colombia's most notorious right-wing paramilitary leaders have been extradited to the United States to face drug trafficking charges. The extradition of the paramilitary kingpins surprised many Colombians and death squad victims who sought the truth in documenting 20 years of murders, assaults, and kidnappings. Outrage among the victims grew earlier this year when U.S. District Judge Reggie Walton blocked public access to seven paramilitary cases. According to the investigative website ProPublica, there is currently no way of knowing if the paramilitary leaders negotiated lighter sentences for cooperation with prosecutors. One defendant who was released on his own recognizance in Maryland has disappeared. These cases have raised red flags among American legal scholars about the practice of sealing entire court records and the power individual judges have to keep case numbers secret. Roxana Altools of the International Human Rights Clinic at the University of California at Berkeley, who represents the Colombian victims, says the U.S. government broke its promise to the victims' families, saying they would have full access to the American legal system. Meanwhile, human rights lawyers have identified an additional 25 cases of paramilitary leaders whose cases are now sealed by U.S. courts.
On the 28th of September, activists from a great variety of groups gathered in front of the FBI's headquarters to protest the raids in Minneapolis and Chicago against the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. Homes were raided, computers and electronics were stolen, and though nobody was arrested, 12 people were handed subpoenas to a grand jury that meets on the 5th of October. The FBI claims that opposition to war and support for the enemies of banks and corporations abroad is material support for terrorism. But it is the opinion of this radio station that it is complying with the subpoenas that would constitute material support for terrorism. Terrorism by the FBI.
They came for the communists in the morning, and I didn't do anything because I was not a communist. And they came for the Jews in the afternoon, and I didn't do anything because I wasn't a Jew. And they came, I believe it was, for the Catholics in the evening, and I didn't do anything because I wasn't a Catholic. And they came for me at night. And nobody did anything because there wasn't anybody.
FBI, stop the raids. We won't back down. We're not afraid. FBI, stop the raids. We won't back down. We're not afraid.
This is war. It's banks versus people. That's what you think it really is, because there's a total restructuring of the society going on right now. Well, if you see more and more being taken away from weapons, and give it to the banks and the military. The thing is that we, as poor working people, are in a war now for our lives, our very lives.
We got to remember history because somebody greeted me today and they remembered when I was carrying on the demonstrations in Boston against Dick Pereira in the Free South Africa movement. Now, if you remember, let me refresh your memory around something. Ronald Reagan was in office and Ronald Reagan referred to the African National Congress as a terrorist organization. As a terrorist organization in solidarity with the white minority rule in South Africa. Now just take that and look at it going forward. If that was now, and the ANC was struggling, none of us who engaged in that movement would be without suspicion by helping basically carry forth the agenda of the African National Congress and the liberation of the people in South Africa. That's what this means. This is an issue where
and of course what they're looking war is not terrorism. They're looking to intimidate all of us. There are 65 cities where rallies like this one have been happening since last Friday. So that shows us that's called fight back. We have to stand up and tell them they're not going to get away with this.
Towards the end, Code Pink tried to deliver a letter suggesting that the FBI raid the homes of the real terrorists with names like Rumsfeld, George Bush, Richard Cheney, and Eric Prince of Blackwater. The FBI went out of their way to keep him out of the building. Oh, finally, somebody accepted the letter, no doubt intending that it go straight to the old circular file, a.k.a. the trash can.
We found some suspects.
It's just tell me the FBI closes at 5 o'clock.
Why are we all back away except for you?
And a terrorist attack.
Yes, sir, an 8 to 5 operation.
The FBI is not interested in knowing who the real terrorists are, I guess. I guess there's not much point delivering a list of terrorists to terrorists.
And just so you know who the real terrorists are, here's an account given at the rally of another FBI raid on an activist's home in Baltimore on made-up, trumped-up heroin charges. Needless to say, no heroin was ever found because these were activists, not heroin dealers.
It's a little special because me, and I must add also myself and another person, were a victim of a police raid in Baltimore where we were charged with being heroin dealers. And obviously that's not true. But after our house being torn apart, our door being broken down, being arrested and drug off to jail in the middle of the night, and after 10 months of campaigning very hard, we eventually won our case because there was no heroin. But, you know, they certainly put us through a lot.
One thing's for sure, these FBI boneheads who threw their fusion centers and joint terrorism task forces put local police up to railroading activists on false charges, making unlawful arrests, and storming people's homes in the middle of the night had got no right to call anybody a terrorist. And they got no business subpoenaing people before grand juries and raiding homes claiming material support for terrorism because somebody stands in solidarity with people in Central America or Palestine who stand against this exact same kind of terror from U.S.-backed regimes abroad. On the 27th of September, thousands of people, many or most from areas being destroyed by mountaintop removal coal mining, descended on D.C. to demand an end to this destructive form of coal mining. In mountaintop removal mining, the whole top of the mountain is blasted away to reveal the coal underneath and the rubble thrown into the valleys below. In all cases, that poisons the local water. People are getting sick of it in more ways than one. The 27th of September was declared the Appalachia Rising Day of Action, and coal country residents converged on the streets of D.C. There were 115 arrests in front of the White House, and a total of 5 civil disobedience actions. In order, they were the occupation of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, with 9 people inside and 40 outside, followed by the occupation of the Department of the Interior for over 2 hours by another affinity group. Both of these actions were carried out by Rising Tide North America, including but not limited to Rising Tide DC. Next came the blockade of the entrances of the Environmental Protection Agency, with protesters demanding that the EPA do their job. This and all the subsequent actions were the work of Appalachia Rising as a whole. After that,
Protesters blocked the entrance to PNC Bank near the White House, a notorious funder of mountaintop removal coal mining.
PNC! You're killing our community! PNC!
Finally came the massive civil disobedience at the White House, leading to 115 arrests. It's not uncommon for people to be arrested in front of the White House in a protest, but it's very uncommon for people from West Virginia and Tennessee, ordinary working people with families, to come and get arrested in front of the White House because their children are being poisoned by mountaintop removal coal mining. Here's what one speaker had to say about the outrage of mountaintop removal.
We are gathered here today to draw attention to the failure of our government to protect the rights of the people and the failure to provide equal protection of the laws. People have suffered a long train of abuses, invariably with the same objective: to enrich the few at the expense of the many. First, the government is failing to protect the future of young people, knowingly allowing and even subsidizing actions that benefit the few at the expense of the public and at the expense of all life sharing this earth. Second, the legislative and executive branches of government knowingly propose actions that demonstrably and utterly fail to preserve our climate and the environment for life. Third, our government allows and contributes to a great hoax perpetrated on the public by moneyed interests aimed at confusing the public about the reality of climate change. We are in danger of becoming the land for the rich and the home of the bride. More than 200 years after the founding of our nation, we face a great moral crisis. Human-made climate change pits the rich and powerful against the young and unborn, against the defenseless, and against nature. The moral issue is comparable to slavery and civil rights. Solution for civil rights was provided by the combination of people in the streets and the courts, which provided equal protection of the laws and ordered desegregation. Brave people have been standing up in West Virginia, in Kentucky, in Tennessee, in Utah, in Australia, in the United Kingdom, around the world. But now is the time to go on the offensive. We should not be begging courts to forgive the brave people who protest. We must ask the courts to order the government to present plans to phase down fossil fuel emissions at a pace dictated by the science, a pace stabilizing climate, preserving nature and future for young people, providing young people equal protection of the laws. We can bring that pace.
And in the end, 115 people were arrested in front of the White House saying no to the mountaintop removal coal that is only a sixth of, say, Pepco's electricity generation, but it's probably 90% of the destruction associated with it.
Over 1,000 activists from the Appalachian coal fields and their supporters met in Washington, D.C. in the last weekend of September for a 2-day conference on how to stop mountaintop removal mining. The conference, titled Appalachia Rising, Voices from the Mountains, was followed by a march, rally, and acts of civil disobedience outside the White House, where more than 100 protesters were arrested. One of the conference speakers was Lorella Scarborough, a resident of Coal River Valley, West Virginia, whose coal miner husband died of black lung disease and whose home was threatened by a nearby mountaintop removal operation. Mountaintop removal is a method of coal extraction where explosives are used to blast the tops off mountains in order to get at the thin seams of coal underneath. The process has literally destroyed the landscape of the region and buried 2,000 miles of streams, creating air and water pollution that is making local residents sick. For the past 5 years, Scarborough has been working to build a wind farm to generate electricity atop Coal River Mountain. She spoke with Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who attended the Appalachia Rising Conference, about the destruction wrought by mountaintop removal coal mining, progress being made to build her wind farm, and the urgent need for a diversity of jobs in the impoverished region.
In early 2007, there was a wind feasibility study done for Coal River Mountain, and it showed that Coal River Mountain had amazing wind potential. It had a lot of between 4 and 7 wind feasibility, 4 being the minimum that you have to have in order to erect an industrial-scale windmill farm. By early 2008, we came together with Coal River Mountain Watch and App Voices and the Sierra Club and Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition. A lot of groups partnered together in order to begin the Coal River Wind Campaign. And the primary purpose of the Coal River Wind Campaign was to first and foremost save that mountain, to keep that mountain intact, and to create renewable energy and green jobs and to actually start rebuilding the area. Since we live at mountaintop removal, we're ground zero for mountaintop removal, and Coal River Mountain is probably the last fully intact mountain range within a 50-mile radius, or was the last fully intact mountain until Massey Energy started mining activity in late 2009. And so we mounted a campaign which showed that we could generate enough power on Coal River Mountain to power 70,000 to 80,000 homes. We could generate revenue for the county that would be above $1.7 million annually for the county. We could create 200 locally trained green jobs during the construction phase, a two-year construction phase. And forever, we could create 40 to 50 jobs on that mountain maintaining the wind farm. Every 20 to 25 years, the wind turbines would have to be replaced, which is another spike of employment. We had an economic feasibility study done for the area, and the economic feasibility study also showed that advocated for a wind turbine factory on Coal River as opposed to the expansion of coal mining. Now, while the Coal River Wind Project would erect an industrial-scale windmill farm on Coal River Mountain, we also advocated and believed that when we stopped, we still believe that when we stop mountaintop removal, there will be an increase in underground, traditional, responsible, room and pillar coal mining jobs. At one time in the state of West Virginia, we had 125,000 coal mining jobs, and now we're down to about 17,000. And so mountaintop removal is not a job creator, it's a job killer. And what we desperately need in the Coal River Valley and throughout Appalachia, throughout the coal towns of Appalachia, is we need job diversity. One of the biggest obstacles in Appalachia is the fact that we have no choices. We live in a monoeconomy, and we have no choices. The only good-paying jobs there are in the industry. That's the way the industry likes it. That's the way the majority of our politicians like it. And for 120 years, we've been fighting to change things. And one of the things that I do on a regular basis, whether it's in my neighborhood, whether it's at the state capitol, or whether it's on Capitol Hill, there are some of us that have made the decision that we've lived our whole lives in Appalachia, in these little coal towns. We plan to spend the rest of our lives there, no matter what happens. They're not driving us out. And that is people in the environmental community and people in the coal industry. On both sides, we've made the decision that we will live and die there. And a small handful of us have made the decision that if we're going to stay there, we need to try to figure out what we can do to make that place a better place. And so we believe that job diversity is a major contributing factor to be able to continue to exist and live on the land that we love and be with the people that we love. You know, there's a song that says, which side are you on? And it's to the point now to where it doesn't matter which side you're on. We all love the same people. And the problem is we're all being used and none of us have any choices. When the fourth largest coal producer in the country decided to come in and blow the top off the mountain behind my house where my property borders Coal River Mountain, I no longer had a choice to stand by anymore and pretend like bad things weren't really happening. And the guys who work for the coal industry and a lot of the guys on the MTR sites don't feel as though they have any choices. You know, there's a limited number of jobs underground. That's the way the industry likes it. And it is a greater profit margin for the coal industry if they can access the coal by blowing the tops off the mountains. And that's why mountaintop removal exists. It's simply a greater profit margin for the coal industry. It makes me very, very angry for people who rape and pillage Appalachia, call themselves coal miners. I think that is it's an enormous insult to my husband, who spent 35 years as an underground union coal miner, and he died of black lung. He gave his life to the industry. And for somebody that is pushing a button and destroying everything around us and destroying the water source, covering over 2,000 miles of headwater streams, decapitating 500 mountains, to call themselves a coal miner is makes me very angry.
That was Lorella Scarborough of Coal River Wind. Visit her organization's website at coalriverwind.org and the conference website at appalachiarising.org.
On the 24th of September, members of Rising Tide DC and Appalachia Rising staged a flash mob at Pepco, demanding an end to their use of coal for mountaintop removal mines.
Let's go! Pepco, we demand that you change ways and go green. Switch to wind and solar and energy that's green. Stop destroying habits, stop climate change today. If you can't get the change, get the heck out of the way. Muscle! Muscle!
At Pepco, or maybe should I say Pep-Cole? People have had enough not only of your rotten service and constant outages, but also of your continued use of 100-year-old coal-fired technology as a source of electricity, especially mountaintop removal coal. It's time to replace mountaintop removal coal with wind and solar, or else. This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
In 2008, environmental activists delivered the money, enthusiasm, and people power that helped elect Barack Obama to the presidency. 2 years later, with continuing unemployment and sagging poll numbers for the Democrats, green activists are being outfinanced and outworked by the energy industry and Tea Party activists. Meanwhile, moderate Democrats who took a risk in voting for a weak cap-and-trade climate change bill addressing energy usage and global warming in the House of Representatives are facing attack ads slamming what they call Nancy Pelosi's job-killing agenda. The funding for these anti-climate change ads comes from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and Koch Industries, which is also bankrolling the Tea Party movement. Sierra Club Chairman Carl Pope says green activists are busy working to defeat Proposition 23 in California, which would repeal the state's progressive global warming law. Energy interests have already raised $8 million for the repeal campaign, including $4 million from Texas-based refiner Valero Energy Corporation. In Ohio, $171,000 has already been spent on anti-climate change ads in the district of Congresswoman Mary Jo Kilroy, who voted in favor of the House climate change bill. Most of the ads were paid for by the conservative group Americans for Prosperity, which is promoting a no-climate tax pledge.
just 1 week, the IMF and the World Bank will be meeting in Washington, D.C. to discuss more austerity for the Great Recession. Already this kind of economics has led to massive street fighting in Spain and huge protests in Brussels, Belgium. Now it's our turn. First with a massive protest against the depression and war on the 2nd of October, then with protests and direct action against the IMF, the World Bank, from the October 8th to October 11th. On Friday, the 8th of October, there will be an anti-capitalist night of action. Meet 16th and Harvard Streets, 10:30 p.m. All day Saturday, the 9th of October, there will be a festival of resistance at Freedom Plaza, 15th and Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest. At 8 p.m. Saturday, the 9th of October, there will be a roving street party. The following day, people will meet to discuss plans for challenging the IMF and World Bank next time around.
The response of people to the worldwide economic crisis varies from nation to nation. Here in the U.S., the most angry and vocal activists have been right-wing groups such as the Tea Party movement, which have called for dramatic cutbacks in government programs and dismantling the nation's frayed social safety net. They first gained attention last summer during protests against President Obama's modest health care reform proposal, later fueled by corporate donors and extensive coverage in the U.S. media. Tea Party candidates have since been victorious in key Republican Party primary battles to run for U.S. Senate seats. In contrast to America's anger on the right, seen most recently at conservative talk show host Glenn Beck's well-attended August 28th rally at the Lincoln Memorial, workers in Europe are mobilizing under a progressive banner. In France, more than a million striking workers marched in Paris in opposition to President Sarkozy's pension reform bill, which will increase the minimum retirement age to 62. Labor and progressive activists have organized a growing wave of coordinated strikes and protests in capitals across the continent opposing government austerity measures with the slogan, "No to austerity, priority for jobs and growth." But a large coalition of U.S. progressive groups are now looking to make some noise of their own about the economic crisis and high unemployment, challenging the rhetoric of Tea Party activists. On Saturday, October 2nd, labor unions and civil rights groups will lead a march and rally in the nation's capital called One Nation Working Together, with the platform One Nation Working Together for Jobs, Justice, and Education for All. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Denise Gray Felder, communications director with the march, who discusses the message of the protest action and how it relates to this November's important midterm congressional election.
Well, the One Nation Working Together, which is a social movement made up of nearly 500 endorsing organizations, is hosting a march on Washington at noon at the Lincoln Memorial in D.C. And the purpose of the march is to help refocus our nation's priorities on jobs, justice, and public education. The three things that we believe are most important for our country to reinvest in and refocus on at this point in our history.
And maybe you could talk about some of the groups that initiated the call to march under the banner of the One Nation Working Together theme.
Well, One Nation Working Together is a movement of people from all backgrounds, faiths, and hues. It ranges from labor unions and civil rights and human rights organizations to youth groups to faith organizations, to non-believers, to environmental organizations, immigration organizations, peace organizations, and everything in between, I like to say.
Was it the NAACP and SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, that got the ball rolling here?
Well, the two men who had the original idea for the march were the president of the NAACP and the president of 1199 of SEIU, yes.
What is the platform of the march? What's the message you want to have echo across the nation from the people gathered in Washington?
Well, we want the people to come together to sort of reclaim our fundamental right to the American dream. And we're defining the American dream in terms that makes sense for the average working person, for the average working family. That means the ability to have a job that's a secure job, allows you to take care of your family, allows you to prepare for your future, and to give your children access to a quality education.
Denise, as I know you're well aware, there's been much media coverage of the march, contrasting it with Glenn Beck, the right-wing radio talk show and TV host, in his rally back on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on August 28th. How do you respond to the idea that this is somehow a counter to Glenn Beck's rally or not?
Well, first of all, I say absolutely it is not a counter to Glenn Beck's rally, because the One Nation Working Together movement actually was in motion as long ago as the spring, sort of late March, early April. The idea for both the movement as well as the march sprung up. So we've been planning this for some time. And so definitely it's not in response to Glenn Beck's march.
How does this march, if at all, relate to the November 2nd midterm congressional election, which, you know, a lot of people are thinking could see power change in Washington in the Capitol, which could mean a dramatic effect on the issues that you're marching for?
Well, clearly, one of the things that we want to have happen starting October 3rd and carrying, you know, forward is for people who care about these critical issues of jobs, I like to say jobs, more jobs, and secure jobs, for them to really vote for candidates in the midterm elections that we all believe are supportive of those issues of jobs, justice, and public education. So we would like for people to take the same energy and the same mobilizing skills that they've used to get to Washington on Saturday and march into the voting booth on November 2nd. And after voting, we want people to remain engaged and to stay committed to holding the people that we vote for accountable. So that will continue way into 2011 and beyond, hopefully.
Denise, how would you contrast the message that's going to be going forth from the One Nation Working Together rally to what we've seen develop over the last year or so of these Tea Party protests, where it seems like there's a lot of negative scapegoating and blaming, you know, this group or that group? How would you contrast it?
Well, I would say that One Nation Working Together is really about moving beyond the divisiveness and the hate that seems to have really overtaken a significant segment of our national discourse. And many of the people that are involved in One Nation Working Together are just tired of that. I mean, we're fed up of people trying to tear us apart at a time when we should really be putting our country back to work and pulling our country back together. So we really have little patience for those who don't want to work together and don't want to focus on the commonalities that we have as people living in this country, as Americans. This is a huge mass of people that are ready to help move this country forward.
That was Denise Gray Felder, Communications Director with the One Nation Working Together March, set for Saturday, October 2nd in Washington, D.C. Contact the march organizers at area code 202-263-4568 or visit their website at onenationworkingtogether.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Melanie Muller, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.